Yeah, so today I was planning at first just to talk about the gravitational wave resonance, which was one of the directions that I have explored during my PhD. But then I decided also to talk a little bit about my work in quantum cosmology after talking with some people that might be also interested in this area. So I will split the presentation in two parts. So the first part is this part about the gravitational wave resonance in neutral light dark matter halos, which is based in this paper here. So I'd like to start talking about what's parametric resonance so that it's clear for everybody what we are talking about, the parameters that are required and so on. And here in the left-hand side, you have this animation of an unusual oscillator that I'm sure all of you have seen during our studies. And in the right-hand side, we have an oscillator that is quite similar to this one, except for the addition of the periodically varying mass term. And then here we have these parameters A and Q, which, well, for now, they are just numbers. They will depend on the dynamics of such an oscillator. And then for some specific values of those parameters A and Q, what happens is that the amplitude of this oscillator will increase very significantly. And this is what we call parametric resonance. And this type of equation that we have there is the so-called Matthew equation. So this is the basic description of parametric resonance. And we can understand why this amplification happens by means of locating stability theory. So we can just rewrite this differential equation in two different first order equations and write it in a matrix form. So here we just redefine this x dot as the pi, and then we write the equation as this matrix equation here, where U would be this matrix. And then we can understand why these amplifications happen if we look into the fundamental matrix of solutions. So we can solve this equation for this fundamental matrix from some initial time t0 up to t0 plus t, which would be the period of the oscillation of the periodically varying mass term. And then what happens in this case is that we end up with a fundamental matrix of solutions that we can get the eigenvalues from it. And this eigenvalue will be directly related to the strength of the amplification that you have for this oscillator. So here we have the mu parameter, which is the so-called Floquet exponent. And then it will be related to those eigenvalues that I'm calling here O plus minus. And the strength of the amplification is quantified by means of mu. And then if you have a real Floquet, part of the Floquet exponent, which is positive, it means you would have this amplification. And then we can plot something like this, binomially solving the equation for the fundamental matrix of solutions, where here we have the parameter A, here we have the parameter Q, and we see here the deep blue region where nothing happens because the Floquet exponent is just zero. And the lighter parts, which are the so-called resonance bands, since they are very well defined, where we have this amplification because the real part of the Floquet exponent is larger than zero. So if you pick the parameters Q and A inside those bands, you would have an exponential amplification. And these banders are centered around 1, 4, 9, and so on. And also by means of the Floquet instability theory, we get that this Floquet exponent will go as Q in the first band, Q squared in the second, and so on. And in the case of the gravitational wave resonance, we are going to see this Q parameter will be a small number. So this would mean that it would lie in this very bottom part of the figure, which means that those bands are very narrow. And that's why in the literature they are called narrow band resonance. So in the context of cosmological perturbations, these parametric resonances are very interesting to look at because once you consider nonlinear interactions, you might have some couplings between, let's say, the gravitational wave or the scalar field or any other type of field. And then because we know that, well, these cosmological perturbations will oscillate inside the horizon, we know that it could create a periodically varying mass term that would lead to such a behavior of amplification of some of the perturbations. And the first direction that we explored related to this parametric resonance was the conversion between the gravitational waves to photons, which does happen because of parametric resonance. But then in cosmological context, it would be very difficult to achieve significant amplifications because in this case, you would need a medium. But this is not the work that I'm going to focus on today. But after working on this, I started asking myself whether there are scenarios where I could amplify gravitation waves instead of damping them by means of parametric resonance. And that's why I considered ultralight dark matter. So first, I would like just to give a brief motivation why to consider those ultralight axions as dark matter candidates. So we know that there is this cusp core problem. And these ultralight axions, they were proposed first of all by string theory and to solve CPT in QCD and other contexts. But also people found out that they could create this core that forms because of the Jeans scale that they have. And this would be an interesting phenomenological implication that these scenarios have. And this is not the only one. So they have many different phenomenological implications. And that's why they are also analyzed by many different phenomenological probes and also widely constrained. So we are going to consider the halo description here as just the ground state of this axion field. So here I have this metric with those gravitational potentials U and U bar that, well, are created because of this halo. And even inside the halo, they are much smaller than one, such a way that we can treat them perturbatively. And here I have the axion field phi, and here the amplitude. And well, I'm considering now just ground state, so it depends only on time. And by getting this scalar field and computing energy density and pressure, we get these expressions here. And this pressure, well, if you consider this well as an equation of state parameter, it will oscillate around the pressureless dust, so it would behave as dark matter. And another very interesting implication of this oscillating pressure is that it would induce oscillations also in other quantities. So for instance, here we have the trace of the energy momentum tensor, the two gravitational potentials, and the Ricci scalar. And the zero quantities are the parts that do not oscillate in time. The delta quantities are the part that oscillate. So this pressure would generate these oscillations also in the gravitational potentials. And then from Einstein equations, you get that the non-oscillating parts of the potentials are the same. We also get the Poisson equation there, and also this differential equation that can be solved to find delta U bar. So we end up with this set of equations after looking into the equations of motion. And then we see that these gravitational potentials have these oscillating contributions in time.
Sorry, this is the real scalar, but you could also do a complex scalar, which
is the oscillation. Yes. Yeah. Well, mainly in this approach, I followed what has been done in order to use a pulsar timing array to constrain ultralight dark matter. So it's a very similar approach to what they consider there. I would say it's the simplest way to describe the halo.
Right, okay, thanks.
And then we see that we have these oscillating gravitational potentials, and then this is interesting from the point of view of resonance because this could create this periodically varying mass term.
How do you get the equation of a state? Is there a specific potential you are assuming?
The equation of state here?
Yeah.
Yes, so it's just a GR minimally coupled to the usual scalar field with m square phi square.
Why is there the pressure?
So this is when you compute like the phi dot half, now I don't know if it's plus minus, and then the potential. And then this would come because of this oscillating behavior of this field. Then it comes directly from these ansatz.
Okay, so then the kinetic term is somewhat dominated.
Sorry?
The usual story is there's the kinetic term and the potential term. Why is it the density constant that the pressure is oscillating?
Yeah, well. But this is because I'm considering the ground state. In principle, one could also consider also the excitations around it, and then this would not be constant, and you would have also a spatial dependence. So this would be mainly the simplest way to consider it, just considering the ground state. So in here, now I don't remember which sign is for each, but one is plus, the other one is minus, right? Like 1/2 of the phi dot square, and then plus minus the potential term. Similarly to what we do, for instance, in inflation.
Yeah, that's why. Why is it that one is time?
Because one is energy which is conserved, the other is one kinetic minus potential which is not conserved. So kinetic plus potential is considered.
Oh, the cosine and sine cancel.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
And these oscillating gravitational potentials, they are interesting from the point of view of gravitational wave resonance, because we need to remember that gravity bends gravity itself. So we can consider tools that have been used for gravitational wave lensing in order to investigate how this oscillating gravitational potential would interact with the gravitational wave. So here we write this gravitational wave as this amplitude times the polarization tensor. And then, as it's usually done in gravitational wave lensing, the polarization tensor is not very important because we only contribute at higher order to the equation of motion, in such a way that we can write this equation of motion for the amplitude as a scalar part, the amplitude of the gravitational wave. And then in the context of ultralight dark matter, we'll know that this metric here will depend on the gravitational potentials, and the gravitational wave could be the oscillator itself that would be amplified. So from this equation of motion, we could get an interaction that might lead to a Matthew equation. So this was the main idea behind it. And then we expand this equation of motion up to linear order in the gravitational potentials and also in the gravitational wave, and we end up with this equation here. And then we perform this time redefinition to this dimensionless time, and also this redefinition of the gravitational wave to Q, the friction terms that we have there. And then we end up in the Fourier space with this expression here. And here we see that it's already, it looks like a Matthew equation, where this would be the A part, and this would be the Q part, the periodically very mass term. And this convolution here, in principle, it's not so trivial to solve analytically because of the dependencies, spatial dependencies of the gravitational potential. But we need to remember that the gravitational potential is much smaller than one. So compared to this part of the this kinetic term here, we can neglect it so that the band would be centered mainly according to this kinetic term. In this one would not be very important. And then we make this approximation for A. And then we end up with a Matthew equation that looks like this one. And then the Q parameter here is just this quantity, which is by definition much smaller than one because it's proportional to the oscillating part of the gravitational potential. So it would be much smaller than one. And as I told you before, because we have this Q parameter much smaller than one, we are in the case of narrow band resonance. So that the first band is the most efficient scenario. So we need to require the parameter A to be one. And this would mean that the wave mode of the gravitational wave would be equal to the axion mass. So there would be this relation between those two quantities in order to achieve the largest amplification possible. And by solving this equation by means of Flockett instability theory, we can estimate this gravitational wave amplification as this exponential function here. And then, well, this the redefined field is very similar to the original one because the factor that relates them is approximately one. And then here I have this animation just to illustrate what would happen with this gravitational wave that is amplified. And here I consider just the fiducial mass, 10 to minus 22 electron volts, and then a realistic very large energy density just to reduce computational time so that we could see this amplification happening. And then in blue, we have the numerical solution. And in orange, we have the Flockett estimate. So this means that indeed there is resonance in the halo if this halo is constituted by ultralight axions. But now we need to understand how strong is this amplification nowadays. Because usually the issue behind parametric resonance is that you need to wait some time for the instability to develop so that you can have a significant amplification.
Yeah, the physics picture is, for example, you have a binary inside the halo.
In principle, because of the relation between the gravitational wave and the axion masses, they would lie in a range that could be either primordial gravitational waves or gravitational waves from supermassive black holes. So in this sense, could be a supermassive black hole binary, for instance, inside the halo, but it could also be primordial gravitational waves in principle.
That passes through the halo.
Yeah.
Just a question of scale. So you neglected the size of the halo. So how does the size of the halo relate to the oscillation time? Is there a hierarchy there so I can consider that homogeneous approximation you're making?
Yeah, so this is a good question because basically I consider what would be the wavelength of the gravitational waves that would be amplified in this case. And then depending on the halo, you could have that this wavelength could be small or comparable. Of course, the cases where it would be much smaller than the halo dimensions is the one that I would trust more. And then for those that are very close to the halo size, then it's more like an extrapolation. Then it's possible that the resonance would not develop well, because this approximation is not valid if this wavelength would be larger than the halo size.
So basically, you assume everything is homogeneous, right?
Yes, just the ground state. So no excitation.
Yeah. The gravitational wave is a small compared. The wavelength of gravitational wave is small.
Yeah, this will depend on the axial mass. But for some, if you consider some halo sizes, then it would fall within the halo.
Yeah, but to have a halo, I mean, at all, you know, the halo size has to be large compared to the de Broglie wavelength.
Yes.
Large compared to, you know, this.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a fine approximation.
Yeah. And the main challenging part about the parametric resonance is to see whether these amplifications are really strong nowadays so that we could really detect them. And this is really challenging for the densities that we have access, for instance, the measured in the solar region, which is 0.4 GeV over cubic centimeter. And for now, we are going just to assume that these axions constitute 100% of dark matter. So let us, for now, not think about the constraints. Later on, I'm going to include the constraints and see how this affects the result. And here we are considering just the most standard case, which would be the solar region and the fiducial mass 10 to minus 22. And then for this case, it takes a huge amount of time to see an order one amplification for the gravitational wave. And here I have also this plot showing how this would change for the other masses. So here we can see that for the very light ones, maybe you could see, well, not a very big amplification, but possibly detectable if you have a very sensitive detector, but it's still very, very small. So that in order to increase this amplification, we need higher densities. So we can't look for it into the, like considering the solar region. And for the densities that we need to consider, we are going to see that they are extremely high. And I could only find them in the literature for those cases of dark matter spikes, which are mainly shown in the cases of cold dark matter. So it would be also an assumption that this could also work for the case of these ultralight axions. So let us see how this would change depending on the very high energy density. So this is the energy density that is necessary in order to have an order one amplification up to 10 to 10 years for the 10 to minus 22 electron volt axion. So it's an extremely high energy density. It can only be found in those dark matter spikes. And then, for the smaller masses, you need smaller energy densities, because this will go as the energy density over mass squared, so that you could compensate this with the value of the mass. And here we have the amplification. So this is the argument of this exponential function here. And in the red line, we have this.
Question.
Yeah?
So you're assuming tau equal to 10 to the 10 years? So you're assuming that your gravitational wave just stay in that halo propagating for 10 to 10 years? I mean, how is that possible? I mean, it will just, the propagation time will be, right? Just halo size divided by speed of light, and that's it. It exceeds the halo and there's
yes.
No effect.
This is a very good question because, well, this is not tau itself, but it will be the time, like physical time, which would be 10 to 10 years. And indeed, you need the gravitational wave to pass through this halo during the whole time of the resonance, that the resonance is occurring. But I would mainly focus on like one point inside this halo. And then this point in space-time would oscillate. For instance, if you have a primordial gravitational wave that passes from since the early universe in this halo, and this point in space-time keeps oscillating during all this time, then you could wait for 10 to 10 years. And for the cases of supermassive black hole binaries, they could take a very long time to merge so that they could keep oscillating, orbiting around each other for up to 10 to 8 years. So it wouldn't be 10 to 10, but it would be up to 10 to 8. And then in this case, there is also the regime where they are very far apart, so much before merger, where this gravitational wave will be like a continuous gravitational wave. So these would be the regimes that you could consider. But indeed, if this gravitational wave doesn't stay enough in the halo, then the resonance wouldn't occur.
So, like, related to that question, like you normally, like, there's not only like the time oscillation, but like there's also a k, which gives you a coherence length and coherence time, right?
Yeah.
So should I replace that time with the coherence time of the scalar field?
Yeah, this is a good question. I haven't thought about this before, but yeah, I think it would be a more reliable approach to consider this scalar.
Yeah. So then, like, there is a basically like when you give me like a mass for the scalar, like, there is a basic time which the maximum time you can integrate, which is 1 over b squared times that.
Yeah. Yeah, I see your point. Yeah, I think you're right. Probably you should take into account.
10 to minus 26 is a billion years, though.
Sorry?
10 to minus 26 is a billion years.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know how to think about 10 minus 26. This is way bigger than. Yeah, anyway.
Right.
But then this is already a very optimistic case where you have access to such extremely dense regions. And once you consider other constraints that are imposed to these ultralight axions as dark matter, then the situation is even harder in order to get a significant amplification. So here I have this parameter space with the constraints, well, CMB Bos and Spark, Eridanus 2, Lyman alpha, and DES. These are implicitly considered because they don't reduce further the parameter space. And one, of course, could also add the 21 centimeters here. But in the literature, there are no reports about only with F1, not with so small fractions of these ultralight axions as dark matter. And then by considering these constraints, then it gets even harder to get the order one amplification. Here I'm still considering the very high energy density, so this would still be optimistic, and for some masses you could achieve significant amplifications, assuming that you could have access to such a very high energy densities. And then for this interval of maxes of the ultralight axions, this would correspond to the gravitational waves in the PTA frequency range. So this would be probably the region where we would want to have an order one amplification, because other than that, we don't have any current detectors that could investigate this possibility of this amplification of the gravitational wave. So for this first part, the main points that I wanted to talk about is that there is parametric resonance between the gravitational waves and these gravitational potentials of these ultralight axions. But it's very difficult to find significant amplifications nowadays if you consider the standard solar region and also the fiducial ultralight axion masses. The only way out would be to consider those very high, very dense regions in the halo, which it's not very clear yet if this could also happen in those cases of ultralight axions. They are reported in the literature for cold dark matter mainly. And then these possible sources for the gravitational waves would be primordial perturbations and supermassive black hole binaries. And we also need to keep in mind that there is always an upper bound on the amplification, because the gravitational wave itself is also a perturbation, so it's always much smaller than one. So you could only consider these amplifications up to some threshold. And then the main points that I think might be worth investigating is because here I consider the simplest scenario possible, so it's just G-arc minimally coupled to the axions. I think that if you consider modified gravity, you might enhance this amplification by introducing another term that could contribute to this periodically very mass term. And also a gravitational wave background instead of one single gravitational wave, because it's been shown in the literature for other contexts in parametric resonance, that if you add noise to this gravitational wave, to this Matthew equation, you further boost the resonance. So this could be possibly one way to make these amplifications become less negligible nowadays. And then, of course, if we can reach, sorry.
Finish them now.
No, that's okay, go ahead.
What about other waves, like density waves or halos are not homogeneous.
Yep.
Is there a parametric resonance of something more significant than gravitational waves that already has a higher amplitude, higher density, wouldn't take?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if one can find a parametric resonance with some other quantities that could be possibly easier to detect and to amplify. So this indeed would be a good direction to look into. I think in ultralight accident cases, since many of the quantities will oscillate, you can find different ways to try to make this parametric resonance happen. But usually the time scale is usually a challenge. So it could be better, but not. I wouldn't be so optimistic.
Sound waves with axions.
I just thought of like normal.
Does it happen? Well, mine is a silly question. Do gravitational waves make rings around black holes? Like, are they gravitational wave rings? Is that like background gravitational waves being trapped and forming rings around black holes?
Oh, so similar to like the photon rings?
Yeah, so that maybe is enough time.
Yeah, but for the time, I wasn't that worried because of the gravitational waves that we are considering. So, for instance, the primordial gravitational waves you consider, they are just there.
Oh, I wasn't
sincerely.
Yeah, I was thinking primordial.
Then, so, but this would be also if you could make such a ring, then it would also be interesting. But I'm not familiar with that.
Once the merger happens, there's a horizon, and they get a stop.
Okay, cool. I'll take a look into that, and then. Of course, if these amplifications can reach a significant amplification nowadays, then it would also be interesting to look whether we could see this with PTA, which now I think it's very, very challenging because, well, the sensitivity of PTA is, well, I think it wouldn't be enough required in order to see this amplification. But maybe if one could boost it with modified gravity or the gravitation wave background, maybe this would be, well, less challenging. So this is the first part that I would like to talk to. And the second part is another direction that I have explored during the PhD, which is the possibility to constrain quantum cosmology-motivated scenarios by using the cosmic microwave background. So this is a work I've done in collaboration with Ruth Duher, Nelson Pinto Neto, and Bartjan van Tent, based on those two papers here. So first of all, I'd like to talk a little bit about the CMB anomalies so that we understand why these scenarios are motivated. And basically, these CMB anomalies, they appear on very large scales. They are those weird features that have a very low probability of happening in lambda CDM. Their significance is not like very high, but they keep appearing in different, like WMAP, Planck, and so on. So they might be physical features, and some people have tried to explain these anomalies, for instance, considering different physics in the very early universe. And these anomalies, they usually for lambda CDM, they have a p-value of more or less 1% for each. So they're a very low probability of happening, and they are namely those three anomalies. So the first one is the power suppression, which is this lack of a two-point correlation function on angular scales larger than 60 degrees. This is the value that is observed. This is the one expected by lambda CDM. We also have the parity asymmetry, which is a preference for odd parity, which would be odd multiples, which would indicate that there is some parity violation for this temperature field in the CMB, also only on very large scales. Where here we can see this plot for the observed value, and then lambda CDM, of course, would expect neutrality. And also the dipolar anomaly, which is this discrepancy between power if you compare the two different hemispheres. So you see that there seems to be a dipole, which regardless of the map that they used in the Planck data, it has this value and some direction that is consistent between all the different approaches. So these are the CMB anomalies on large scales. They might be consistent with lambda CDM, just very unlikely. Or they might be the evidence for some new physics. And then there was a very interesting proposal in the literature, which was a scenario that has a bounce followed by an inflationary phase, where this bounce came first from loop quantum cosmology. So you have this phase of quantum cosmology where these quantum effects dominate. So around the bounds, you would have this scale factor here, where AB would be the minimum scale factor. And then this N here would determine what type of scenario you consider. So if it's 1 over 6, this would be loop quantum cosmology. And then for other values, it could be other types of matter bounces. And then the idea was the following. Since they have this bounce followed by inflation, if you set initial conditions in the minus infinity as the adiabatic Bunch-Davis vacuum, these perturbations would go through the bounce. And then when they reach inflation, they would be already in another initial state, which is not a Bunch-Davis anymore. And that would excite these non-Gaussianities. And then since you have these non-Gaussianities, you could correlate modes that are super horizon with modes that are very large scales. So by doing this, they could create this modulation of the power spectrum in such a way that they could require the power suppression to have a higher probability of happening. Because this modulation here, it's basically represented by this delta parameter. And this follows a probability distribution, which is a Gaussian with a zero mean. And then the standard deviation is given by this expression here, where, well, here we have a spectator mode outside the horizon. Here we have the power spectrum. And this quantity here would be proportional to the strength of the non-Gaussianity. So the higher the non-Gaussianity you have here, the higher modulation you could create in this power spectrum. So this was their idea, to use the non-Gaussianity in order to modulate the power spectrum in the regions where the anomalies happen. So that the higher the non-Gaussianity you have, the higher the probability you have to achieve, for instance, the power suppression. So this was their main idea. And they considered different scenarios. And here I picked two to talk about, which is the first one is the loop quantum cosmology case. And the second one is a phenomenological bounce, which best fits the data, which was also a result found by Agulu and collaborators. And here we have this.
Sorry, can you go back for a second? Right, so n is a, n16 is from LQC.
Yeah.
But then you could also treat it as a free parameter.
Yes, exactly.
So the bounce is at the good.
Yeah. So like by using the best fit and considering this exponent as a free parameter, then they get this 0.21 as the best fit.
So does n somehow enter in the form of the bispectrum or does?
Yes, it will enter in the bispectrum because, well, we are going to see the expressions in a minute. But it will enter basically in the power spectrum because it will break it in three different regions and also in the bispectrum itself.
So why does n of 1/6 is like it looks like it goes as t to the 1/3.
Sorry, it looks like?
A of t goes asymptotically as t to the 1/3.
Yeah.
So why is that expected from the QC, t to the 1/3? I don't recognize.
Well, I'm mainly familiar with that. Which would be the exponent that you would expect?
I mean, the radiation error, well, I guess, actually, I don't know what to expect. Radiation error is t to the 1/2, that's all I know.
Yeah, so I've mainly worked with other quantum cosmology scenarios. So the loop quantum cosmology that I'm familiar with is the one from this group, Agulu, Ivan Agulu and his collaborators. And then in their case, the scale factor has this exponent 1/6 for loop quantum cosmology.
The bounce phase afterwards it becomes exponential, you said.
Yeah, then it will be there will be an inflationary phase. Yeah, this is just close to the bounce. Yeah.
Does the is there like a limit on how long inflation must have happened in these theories so that you can see deviations from like say this early.
Yes, so basically when they introduce this bounce, then introduce a new scale in the problem. So you have the inflationary scale, also the bounce scale. And then what you need to do to make sure that, well, all the observations related to the power spectrum are fine, except for the very large scales which are modified,
yeah,
would be to pick the bounce scale to be the pivot scale.
Right, and then that needs to be a type of scale that we are potentially observable with the Hubble scale now.
Yeah, so basically they choose this scale so that all the modifications that you would see would be, well, in principle they expected it to be only very large scales.
Yeah.
And then
but like
inside the horizon.
Say 500 e-folds instead of 50 or 60.
Yeah, no, they do.
Not to have any observables, like, you know.
Yeah, no, they do have a limit also for the duration of inflation.
Yeah.
And also, they explain all those details in a paper where they show why this inflationary phase will be motivated as like an attractor after this bounce.
Oh, really?
But yeah, but you need to consider some specific parameters in order to make everything fall into place in the power spectrum. But then they consider those two scenarios, where here we have the values of the parameter FNL when we require the power suppression to have a probability of 20% of happening in this scenario. So instead of the 1% in lambda CDM, you increase it to 20%. And then this also depends on the curvature at the bounce. So you could either have slightly smaller, slightly larger values of FNL. But probably you already realize that these are indeed very high values for this parameter FNL. So this is only possible because the bispectrum that they obtain from this scenario decays exponentially. So this is a fit to a numerical results that they have for this bispectrum, where here we have the FNL parameter, which would be those large numbers, but then it will decay exponentially. So in principle, they thought it would be fine because it would have those huge FNL values on very large scales that then would correlate to those modes and make this power suppression work on very large scales. And then it would be washed out very quickly so that they thought it wouldn't be observable. So this was their idea in order to alleviate the anomalies.
Can I ask, how is this a bispectrum? I mean, shouldn't that be zero? Okay, well, it's just a maybe silly question. K1 plus K2.
Where, sorry?
Oh, I guess these are like amplitudes. Okay, sorry, never mind.
Fine?
Yeah, sorry.
Can I also ask, so the power is supposed to go be amplified in low K units, but then
the
negative Q.
Yeah, well, the shape will be similar to like, it will decay much quicker than local, but it will peak for low K is low L.
But they want to amplify the power address the anomaly, right?
Sorry?
Address the anomaly on the larger scale.
Mm-hmm.
They want the power to go higher in the low K values, right?
To have the power suppression so that it agrees with the data.
Oh,
yeah, so like this this delta here will be integrated from minus infinity up, so it will be negative. So mainly you created this modulation so that this power suppression would be more likely.
So a small k delta goes lower, large k goes higher, smaller or something like that.
Yeah, well, for large k, it washes out completely, the bispectrum. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because of this part here. So the idea is that we would only have this bispectrum on very large scales. And then for lower K, it's almost, we are going to see that it will be very difficult to detect it.
With that,
let's
think that puzzle me is the Q value is negative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no. K is the actual X, so K is positive.
Yeah.
Small K.
Yeah.
So there's no actual form for these from the theory because this looks like just a broken power law.
Yeah, so this is mainly because they introduced the bounce. So like one of these scales would be the bounce scale, and then the other one the inflationary scale. This one inflationary, this one the bounce scale. So that you have these three different regimes in the power spectrum, where this one would be the almost scaling variant. And then the other one, they pick it to be a very large scale so that you wouldn't detect it. But yeah, it would have those three regimes. And the power spectrum, you can compute analytically, and the bispectrum is the one that they use a numerical fit to their results. And then I think they were very successful in their aim to alleviate these anomalies, because here we can see this first plot about the power suppression, where the green and red curves are the ones that represent the bounce scenarios. And then lambda CDM is the bluish one, and Planck here in black. And we can see that, they indeed created this power suppression here. And also, and this is, of course, in an individual realization of the CNB map. So they increase the probability that this happens and show the case where this power suppression does happen. And then here we have the preference for the odd multiples, where here Planck in black, the green and red for the bounce, and here the one expected from the CDN. So they get closer to the observations. And then here for the dipole, they also have this dipole that is generated. And the interesting thing is that the only thing that they require was the power suppression. So all the other features, they came like for granted. So they only require that this would have 20% of probability of happening, which may indicate that these anomalies might be related somehow.
What's the p-value here?
It would be 20%. And then something that they also addressed was the issue with the lensing parameter in the Planck data, which is well set as a free parameter as a consistency test. And then when you best fit it, you should recover one. And then what happens is that in the data, it's more than two sigma away from one, which is not very significant. But in their scenario, also this lensing parameter goes closer to one, as it would be expected. So it seems that this scenario has some phenomenological interesting implications. And we wanted to see if indeed they would they could make it work without spoiling the non-Gaussianities, because indeed the values of FNL are very high. At first glance, we thought that maybe it would be fine indeed because of the exponential decay, but we wanted to check it explicitly by computing the CNB bispectrum. So here we have this expression for the reduced bispectrum in the CNB, where the primordial bispectrum would enter here. So here we have that exponential suppression. And then here we have the transfer function. Here's the spherical Bessel function. And then because we are now focusing mainly on very large scales, we can approximate the transfer function by considering just the Sachs-Wolff plateau, which would be this expression here, which is also a spherical Bessel function. So this is a ugly integration because you have the product of those two spherical Bessel functions, then something, well, to square, and then as exponential suppression. So it's not possible to do it analytically, but it is possible to do it numerically if we recall that, well, the product of those two spherical Bessel functions will create some superposition when x equals to t0 minus t decoupling. And then if you integrate only around these regions, you make this integration numerically possible. And then we end up with these blue dots here, which are fitted by this black curve. So here we have the reduced bispectrum. And as they expected, this would indeed decay very quickly as you go to higher Ls. But then we were interested in see if this would be detectable. So we want to compute the signal to noise. So here we have an estimator for the variance, which is given by this expression here. For now, we are just considering cosmic variance, so no experimental noise for now. And we could compare also this bispectrum, which is are those blue dots here, with cosmic variance, which is this gray line. And this one is the local bispectrum with FNL5, just for comparison. So this bispectrum seems to be on very large scales larger than the local, but apparently smaller than cosmic variance. But indeed, what happens is that if you consider more numerical points in here, you will see that this curve will go up. And then for very large scales here, the bispectrum could surpass the cosmic variance. And then in the signal-to-noise ratio, since you sum over these multiples many, many times, this would indeed lead to a very significant contribution. So that's how we found this signal-to-noise ratio of 25. This is for the case for loop quantum cosmology. And then for all the other cases, also very high signal-to-noise ratios. So this was the moment where we realized that this should be detectable in the Planck data. But since this shape is not very usual, it's not like the local orthogonal, then it would be possible that people haven't looked into it yet. So we decided to search for it in the Planck data. So in order to do that, we had to, well, go back and change some approximations that we made to consider everything fully numerically. And the main point was the transfer functions, which we considered previously just the Sachs-Wolff contribution. And in order to compare this with the data, we obtained the full numerical transfer function from class, and then repeated all the computations. And then we obtained this reduced bispectrum. This is just a change of notation. This is still the same as small b as the other plot.
So just to have a picture of what's going on here. this, the transform, this is, so the modes have been created and they have by spectrum, but the scales you're looking at, they are not impacted during inflation, or some of them are subpolarized during inflation?
Yeah, so in those three different regions of the power spectrum, you have different modes that are affected by each. So there is a region of modes that will be only affected by inflation, another one that will be combined bounce and inflation. So it will depend when they would cross.
And then you add the transfer function afterwards.
Yes, yeah. So yeah, this transfer function is mainly just the usual one from CNB, so it doesn't have any special property, because in the observable scales, it will be mainly the usual almost scale invariant spectrum.
And so, but you have processed them differently to the inflation.
Yeah. And then we consider here this fully numerical transfer function, and we obtain this new dark blue result, where the light blue fit is what we obtained previously with the transfer function. And we see here that this fit overestimates a bit the bispectrum, so we need to be careful, because in the signal-to-noise ratio, this was the most important contribution. But in the end, it won't affect much the results. And here, just this 3D plot, just to show this small overestimation of the fit using the approximated transfer function. And then what we did in order to compare this with the data was to just do the template fitting between the theoretical bispectrum here and the observed one, with the one from the data. Normalizing it by this, where this inner product is defined in this way here, where here we have the variance. In our case, just the temperature data was enough, so adding polarization doesn't change much. If you add polarization, then you need to consider here a covariance matrix instead of the variance itself. But then we consider these correlations here between these templates of the bounce and also other equilateral, orthogonal, and local shapes. By using this Fisher matrix. And what we find is that, well, indeed, there's no much correlation between this template and the other ones, and also not much correlation with foregrounds. Of course, it has a very high correlation between the two different bounce scenarios. But the main point is that by considering this estimator for the FNL parameter, what we see is that these are the values that we obtain with the Fisher errors. So this is the case for loop quantum cosmology, and the other one is the case for the phenomenological bounce, which would best fit the data in the power spectrum level. And then in the bispectrum level, they are both excluded with very high significance, so 60.4 sigma and 14 sigma, respectively. So this would mean that these scenarios that are inspired by loop quantum cosmology that alleviate the anomalies are excluded by the data. This doesn't mean that loop quantum cosmology as a whole would be excluded, just if they aim at solving, at mitigating the anomalies. Of course, they lose a little bit of this phenomenological motivation behind it, because, well, it was interesting that they could solve many anomalies at once, but unfortunately, they can't be compatible with the non-Gaussianity data.
Is the KB scale is fixed, so you're just constraining the amplitude of the bispectrum here, not the shape?
Yes, well, the KB scale is fixed. It will be the scale of the bounce, which in the end is the pivot scale, the usual one in Planck. So we need, once you fix this scale, the value of FNL that you get to achieve 20% of p-value for the power suppression will depend on this choice. So they are kind of attached. If you change this scale, then probably you have to compute FNL again, because it will be another value. And of course, if you make it smaller and smaller, then you would require a higher FNL in order to achieve the 20%. So it, in the end, it balances out.
And why did you say it's excluded? 160 minus
15. Sorry? Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Why is it excluded? Because it still crosses zero. That 1 sigma?
Yes, yeah, so this is excluded because we are comparing these values with the ones that are required for the 20%, which are these. So then that for this reason they are excluded with high significances. And the main points that I would like to stress about this part is that, well, despite the fact that they do decay exponentially, that this power spectrum does, this bispectrum does decay exponentially, it could still be visible in the data, and indeed it's excluded with very high significances. And this happens for all the other types of matter bounces that we consider, so other values of n are equivalent to the Q parameter. And then at this point, we decided then to consider, well, okay, they cannot make this happen with a 20% probability, maybe with 10 or maybe with 5. But in all those cases, they are, of course, less excluded, but it's still significantly excluded. And then for 5%, they kind of lose a bit of the of their appeal, because in the end, the lambda CDM has 1%. So it wouldn't be much higher than lambda CDM itself. And this is a very interesting result, because this would show the sensitivity of the Planck data even beyond the pivot scale. So we are usually we think that, oh, on very large scales, we can do whatever because you have cosmic variance, and then you won't be able to see it. And in the end, it's not how it works. Indeed, you have some sensitivity even with Planck data to go beyond these scales, especially if you have non-Gaussianity. So this is also valid for other modulations, maybe not inspired in bounces, but other types of modulations proposed to solve these anomalies. They also need to be careful about those effects on very large scales. And finally, the main point about this talk, I think, is that exploring quantum cosmology is possible even with data that we already have. Of course, we have all the limitations of the very high energy scales, but we could still search for those imprints. And sometimes we can find something interesting, even if it's to exclude the scenarios. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, so we have time for questions. So are there further questions for a problem?
So are the large scale anomalies physics or statistics?
Well, good question. That's a good question. So because of the significances, I don't think they are like the main issues that we need to address like as soon as possible, because maybe indeed they are just statistical. What I find weird is that they are seen by different probes. So WMAP sees it, Planck sees it, and then regardless of the type of a map that you consider in Planck, for instance, they still see the same thing. So it's a bit weird. So one of the directions that I think it would be very interesting to explore related to this, well, of course, this would be very optimistic, but if we had access to primordial gravitational wave background, and we treat this similarly as we do for CMB, for instance, if this anomaly is physical, then it should appear also in the other background. So I think this could be one of the ways to see if this is indeed physical or just, or it might be that they are just statistical, yeah.
So that premise putting that would mean that there's a statistical anisotropy of the PTA signal?
So about the gravitational wave. Sorry, so what's the question?
Like, so what would be the observable, like the PTA signal, but like a statistical anisotropy of that PTA signal?
Yeah, so being very optimistic that you could find a significant amplification in those very dense regions, then you would have to follow a PTA data for some time, right? And this time...
Sorry, are you asking about the second part of the talk?
No, the first part.
Which part of the talk are you asking about?
Oh, I was asking for the second part.
Just this one.
Yeah. Ah, for the second part, okay.
Like what you just mentioned, is that getting the analogy of the anomaly in the gravitational wave.
Ah, okay, yes, yeah.
I assume you were talking about PTA.
Yeah, PTA would be.
It was about the statistical anisotropy of the PTA.
Yeah, well, of course, it could also be the B-modes in the CMB, but...
Oh, that's what you meant.
But well, assuming that we ever detect it, then once we have it, then it would be a way to test if those anomalies are.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, the p-value of 1% for lambda CDM, is it for, because you said that they see it in different experiment and different analysis, so is it the p-value associated with one analysis or like... anomaly appearing like in all these different things at the same.
So this 1% is from Planck. I'm not sure what is the p-value in WMAP, but they see similar features, so probably it's also a small probability. But this would be from Planck.
Because if they are uncorrelated, then the p-value of seeing it in multiple channels, it would be probably even smaller, right?
Yeah, probably if you consider WMAP, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good, it's a good point.
So this is very tempting to just multiply all the p-values and get various small numbers. And, people do that, and other people say it's a terrible thing to do. It's a question of a posteriori statistics. That is like, I see this weird thing, and I see this, and then this weird thing, and this weird thing, and they're all, and multiplying the probability of all of them is gives you a small number, but the reason you identified is that they were weird. There were all sorts of other things you looked at that are not weird. So it's a tricky business combining these things.
Yeah, and then you can also, well, analyze each p-value individually or all of them together.
So. Yeah.
But individually, they are 1%.
Any more questions or online? Okay, if not, okay, well, so Paolo will be here today and tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So let's break here and then go to lunch. So thanks again.
Thank you.